On June 30th, over 14 million Egyptians took to the streets demanding that President Mohamed Morsi step down. On July 3rd, the Egyptian military forced him out and suspended the constitution. Since then, there has been violence and bloodshed. Pro and anti-Morsi supporters took to the streets on Friday and Saturday. 35 people were killed, and this morning at least 51 pro-Morsi demonstrators were killed by the military. So on today's Your Call, we'll get the latest from Egypt and talk about what's in store for the future of the largest nation in the Arab world. What do you want to know about what's happening right now in Egypt? Join us after the news.
BBC News with David Austin. Egyptian officials now say that more than 50 people were killed this morning in Cairo as soldiers and police clashed with Islamists protesting against the ousting of President Mohamed Morsi. The Muslim Brotherhood has accused the security forces of a massacre, but the police and military say they acted in self-defense after armed men tried to storm the Republican Guard headquarters, throwing stones and petrol bombs. Colonel Ahmed Mohamed Ali is a spokesman for the Egyptian army.
And despite the measures taken by the armed forces, we were met with incitement and provocative acts targeting or encouraging the protesters to use violence and to target military institutions and buildings.
The interim president, Adli Mansour, has called for restraint from all sides. As Jim Muir reports from Cairo, the violence has had a huge impact on Egypt.
It's sharpened the rift and the confrontation between the army and the Muslim Brotherhood, which has called on its followers to rise up against what it's calling a military coup against democracy. It's also dealt a huge blow to efforts to find a political way out of the crisis by seeking a consensus on a new interim prime minister to start trying to stabilize the country through a transitional government. The temporary president has ordered an inquiry into the deadly incident, the worst since the current crisis began, and the violence has been condemned by many political and religious figures. But it will take more than that to pull Egypt back from the brink.
A French court has acquitted the French oil giant Total, its chief executive and a former interior minister, of charges related to corruption in the United Nations Oil for Food program in Iraq. Hugh Schofield reports from Paris.
The UN's Oil for Food program was designed to ease some of the humanitarian side effects of the international sanctions that were then in force against Iraq. Under Saddam Hussein's leadership, the country was allowed to sell limited quantities of oil in order to buy in some food and medicines. But it's now known that the system was mired in corruption. Iraqi officials selected preferred foreign partners who then used a variety of dodges to channel money either to their own accounts or back to Iraq. It was claimed that the oil group Total was involved in the scam, as well as the 86-year-old former interior minister Charles Pasqua. But in its judgment, the court ruled that the evidence was unconvincing.
70 Western retailers and brands have finalized a plan to conduct coordinated inspections of clothing factories in Bangladesh in an attempt to improve safety standards. The code was announced earlier this year after the collapse of a factory in Bangladesh in April that killed more than 1,100 people. World News from the BBC. 2 days after a runaway fuel train exploded in Canada, destroying part of the small town of Lac-Mégantic in Quebec, the authorities say they're yet to begin a wider search to locate up to 40 missing people. 5 people are confirmed dead, but fire crews have been unable to search for more victims because dozens of tanker wagons loaded with oil remain strewn across the site. In Britain, a report on child abuse at care homes in North Wales up to 40 years ago has finally been published, almost 2 decades after it was completed. 7 former care workers were convicted in 1991 on charges related to child abuse. But the findings of a later inquiry were shelved due to fears that the local authority could face compensation claims. Our British Affairs correspondent Rob Broomby reports.
The victims had demanded the release of the report into sexual and physical child abuse in North Wales care homes. 17 years later, they got their wish. The report reveals extensive abuse from the 1970s and 80s. More than 3,700 witnesses were heard. At least 24 victims were identified, though a current investigation is assessing almost six times as many allegations. The victims want apologies. Children's charities have expressed anger and outrage at the delays. They say lessons have to be learned.
The leader of the radical feminist group Femen, Inna Shevchenko, says she's been granted political asylum in France. She said she feared persecution in her homeland, Ukraine, after sawing down a large wooden cross in Kiev to show her support for the jailed Russian rock band Pussy Riot. Manchester United Football Club has announced a five-year partnership with the Russian airline Aeroflot, replacing a previous deal with Turkish Airlines. United said it already had nearly 18 million fans in Russia, and the deal would help it explore the market further. It's the latest Russian investment in European football. That's the latest BBC News.
Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. At least 51 people were killed this morning during prayers outside of the barracks in Cairo, Egypt, where President Mohamed Morsi is reportedly being held. More than 430 people were wounded. Morsi supporters say they will continue their actions until he returns to the presidential palace. Citizens who took to the streets to have Morsi ousted are also continuing their protests. According to reports, clashes left at least 35 people dead on Friday and Saturday. And it all started on June 30th, when over 20 million people poured into Cairo's iconic Tahrir Square and other cities across Egypt, demanding President Morsi step down. On July 3rd, with the direct intervention of the country's powerful military, Morsi's one-year term came to an end. Many questions remain. Was it a military coup d'etat, or was it the continuation of the 2011 revolution? How should we understand the socio-political dynamics in Egypt, and what galvanized tens of millions of people to take to the streets? What happens to the Muslim Brotherhood and its supporters who voted for Morsi? Joining us to discuss all of these questions is Mona Atai. She is Assistant Professor of Geography and International Affairs at George Washington University, and she just returned from Egypt, and she joins us from Washington. Hi, Mona. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks very much for having me.
Nice to have you. We're also joined by Adel Iskandar. He's scholar of Arab studies, whose research focuses on media and communication. He's a lecturer at Georgetown, and his most recent book is Egypt in Flux, Essays on an Unfinished Revolution. And he joins us from Washington. Hi, Adel. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Hi. Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you. And we'll check in with Wael Iskandar, who is on our Friday show, joining us from Cairo in about 10 minutes. So, Adel, things are moving so quickly and changing, and at least 51 people were killed this morning. The reports say that the numbers might be higher. Give us a sense of what you know about what happened this morning.
Well, I mean, I think the concerns are that the realities on the ground are very difficult to decipher. I mean, the political scene in Egypt is deeply polarizing, which means that the representations of, you know, what led to what or how the situation escalated at the Republican Guards sit-in is not entirely clear. We know that it happened very early in the morning. The military has already had a press conference and implicated the protesters, the pro-Morsi protesters, and said that they initiated the confrontations by using, birdshot and various other things, and tried to ascend onto the military facility where they believe that Morsi is being held in detention. The other side, of course, the Muslim Brotherhood claimed that this was uncalled for, that there was no instigation on their part at all, and that live ammunition was used on a very widespread basis against peaceful protesters, in some cases even saying that it happened during their prayer. So it's a deeply polarizing moment. The reality is really kind of lost in the fog of the political polarization, and there's no real sort of reliable source of information at this point. There are very few media institutions or broadcasters or journalists who haven't found themselves on one side of this political spectrum or another. There was a press conference today with the military. The Al Jazeera reporters were basically driven out by some of the Egyptian reporters who were on site. They were forced to leave the press conference because of Al Jazeera's coverage. So, again, you know, how to confirm and how to verify and corroborate information is really part of the problem right now.
Where are you getting your information?
I'm trying to do I'm trying to do what anybody else is trying to do, is basically expose myself to as many different and conflicting sources as possible, and hope that the truth or the information can be verified from more than one source, and try to piece the puzzle together. But at the end of the day, I think there's a real sort of crisis of journalism from Egypt today, not just among Egyptian journalists, but by sort of reporters and international media trying to understand and comprehend, what led to what, and not just with regard to this specific incident, but rather the sort of the larger, political circumstances in Egypt and where popular support lies, the role of the military, what the military wants to see and what it doesn't want to see, and what does it mean to have political mobilization. So really, there are more questions than answers coming out of Egypt today, and I think academics and scholars and thinkers and writers and commentators are being forced to offer opinions a little too preemptively and a little too soon without sort of the necessary sort of meditative process that will produce meaningful evaluative answers.
And Mona, you're concerned about the opposition demanding clarity about the violence, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But when you step back, I mean, how do you assess what is happening? Because the media reports, they don't provide all that much context. It's just sort of Morsi was ousted, he's reportedly held up here, and there are now pro and anti demonstrations. Can you just give us your assessment? How are you making sense of what's happening right now?
In terms of the broader context, I think if we step back even just 6 months to the beginning of the decline of legitimacy of the Morsi government, really began with the constitutional declaration in November, the ongoing attack on the independence of the judiciary, on the pursuit of partisan politics, and then ramming through a constitution without building consensus. And I really think that November, December of last year was really the beginning of starting to see the unfolding of a move of the regime, and also the beginning of a movement against Muslim Brotherhood. Moving forward, even just a month ago, there was a lot of sort of rumblings about Tamarit, about the rebellion campaign, but it really caught a huge amount of momentum on the heels of people just being frustrated and fed up with the daily struggles of trying to live in a climate of instability, of economic decline, of a lack of consensus politics. And that's really what led up to this moment. So when we think about democracy, the other thing is that democracy is not just about what happens in the ballot box. It's about the everyday actions of those in power. It's about the everyday politics. And that's really what this struggle sort of overall is about.
What would you add to that, Adele, when you step back and provide some context here?
I think Mona essentially nailed it, that basically the country had sort of started polarizing when Morsi decided that he would no longer represent the best interests of the Egyptian public at large with Egypt with all of its variation. I mean, there's the supposition on both sides that Egypt is an extremely homogeneous society where everyone agrees, and I think that was the premise of Muslim Brotherhood's actions, that they, because of their electoral gains in consecutive sort of voting sessions and electoral sessions, that they basically had a full mandate to enact anything that they saw fit, irrespective of how the opposition saw things, and without complete disregard of the average Egyptian's view on these things. And I think they've come to be surprised that Egyptians are extremely adept at reading political discourse, that they're able to to act when they see it necessary. But they saw, for instance, the Muslim Brotherhood's robbing, essentially, of the Constitution as a deeply disenfranchising action, and that they rose up against it. I mean, keep in mind that they were, Mona described what happened in November and December when the Constitutional Declaration came out. They gave Morsi a sort of absolute sort of power during that period, and there were mass protests during then as well. So I think what had started then had become much more entrenched over the past few months to reach a crescendo on June 30th. And so basically, you know, there something had to give, and the Muslim Brotherhood are in a position now where they need to reconcile, they need to reach across the aisle, they need to sit down and really negotiate rather than play the game of political brinksmanship and really use sort of human life as a threat to both the armed forces and their opposition. So, you know, something has to be resolved right now. But unfortunately, the seeds of discontentment had started during the reign of Mohamed Morsi a good 6 to 9 months ago, as Mona described.
And Mona, you've been to Egypt over the years. You just got back. I mean, what are you hearing from people about not only Morsi, but just what's happening in Egypt? Talk a little bit about what people are saying.
Sure. I mean, obviously, things change pretty much every hour at this point, but the genuine sentiment has been that people are exhausted by the political impasse, frustrated with the lack of progress in terms of moving forward politically, and then just, you know, I do sense a there's both fear and hope at the same time, that this could be a moment that things could change. There also seems to be a bit of naivety resurfacing towards the role of the military, or the lack that the military somehow represents the interests of the whole populace. So, you know, there's also a lot of extreme hate speech going on both sides, which is also extremely troublesome, just in terms of really I have heard very few voices talking about consensus building, talking, for example, about what the role of the Muslim Brotherhood should be moving forward. So there's a lot of mixed, I would say, sentiment on the street in terms of attitudes towards what's happening. But I would say the prevailing sentiment is confusion, you know, tinged with fear and hope.
What would you add to that, Adele? The UN just came out with some new numbers about poverty and hunger, and they say that both have risen significantly over the past 3 years. About 17% or almost 14 million Egyptians suffer from hunger compared to 14% in 2009. The unemployment rate is going up. So can you talk a little bit about these social issues?
Well, I mean, it's, you know, these numbers are basically the tip of the iceberg. I mean, we know that data collection in Egypt for both through polling and through research tends to be limited to access. And I think, you know, the numbers are probably much more drastic than that. Hmm. But it's really part and parcel of a descent that has been going on from the time of Mubarak, the late period of Mubarak, due to sort of these structural adjustment programs imposed by the IMF and the World Bank. Egypt records great numbers economically, you know, as far as macroeconomic numbers, but in the grand scheme of things, when it comes to trickle-down, it tends to be quite poor. But what we've seen over the past 3 years since the revolution is literally a spiraling out of control. I mean, there are certain industries that have come to a virtual complete standstill, like the tourism industry, which brings in a significant amount of revenue and employs many families in Egypt. Today, tourism seems like a distant memory of the past. So it's a really unfortunate situation, but it speaks to the fact that anyone whose ambitions are to rule Egypt today must be able to answer those questions, those economic and social and political questions, immediately, and that it has to be a conciliatory process. I mean, no single group, organization, or political force or ideology needs to be sort of forgotten or left or to fall through the cracks, because this is sort of a collaborative effort. Unfortunately, the discourse coming out of the political elite primarily the Muslim Brotherhood originally during the time of Morsi, and now we're hearing it from both the military and everyone else, as Mona explained, has created rifts and is really tearing at the social fabric of society to the extent that it's going to make it even more complicated and more difficult to rise to the occasion to speak to the social and economic conditions in Egypt today. I mean, how do you begin to build an economic policy moving forward when you've got intransigence from one side or another? During Morsi's time, intransigence from the opposition and really largely a result of Muslim Brotherhood's policies. And then now we're seeing sort of a deep intent on the part of the opposition and the military and Egyptians at large to go after the Muslim Brotherhood and to effectively extricate them from the political process altogether. So to answer these big questions about the economy and the basic needs of Egyptians on a daily basis, there needs to be a coming together. And unfortunately, all the signs over the past few days and weeks in the past has not indicated that any of this is coming to fruition.
That is Adel Iskandar, scholar of Arab studies, whose research focuses on media and communication. He's a lecturer at Georgetown, and his most recent book is Egypt in Flux, Essays on an Unfinished Revolution. Mona Atiya is assistant professor of geography and international affairs at the George Washington University. She's just back from Egypt, and we're talking about what is happening on the ground in Egypt on July 30th with a direct intervention of the country's powerful military. President Mohamed Morsi's one-year term came to an end. And this is a country of 84 million people, the largest in the Arab world. If you have any questions about what's happening in Egypt, we'd love to hear from you. If you're from there and you've been talking to family and friends, what are you hearing from people on the ground? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. And now I would like to welcome Wael Eskandar to the show. Wael is a blogger and writer for Egypt's Aram Online. He's been covering the protests, and he joins us from Cairo. Hi, Wael. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
So, Wael, what's getting so much attention in the media here in the U.S. is the bloodshed that happened this morning. At least 51 people were killed during prayers outside of the barracks where Morsi is reportedly being held. Can you give us an update about what happened this morning?
It's very difficult to know exactly what happened. Stories are accusing one another, but what we know for sure is that there was some kind of fight that broke out using a gunfire exchange between the Muslim Brotherhood and the army and the police. How it started is not evident, but there was gunfire exchanged, and there was casualties, a lot of casualties from the Muslim Brotherhood due to the live ammunition. It took from a little before 4 a.m. and then all throughout the morning until like 5 or 6. This was the extent of it. And footage has appeared where we see both sides firing, actually. The military has come out and said that, no, it was the Muslim Brotherhood who attacked. And the Brotherhood have said that the army were the ones who attacked them. And the real problem with this situation is that we don't have reliable sources that we can trust. Both sides have been known to lie about how things started or the details. And so it's we're not very sure exactly what happened or what provoked that. So it's a very difficult situation, and the casualties are high, and this is raising a lot of tension in Egypt, actually.
How is the opposition responding to what happened this morning?
The opposition, or the biggest bloc, is the NSF, is condemning violence and has asked for an investigation into these events. I think that they have yet to determine exactly what happened in order to have a response, but perhaps the safest way is to condemn any use of violence.
And Mona, you're concerned about this. You're concerned about the opposition maybe not demanding clarity about violence. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, well, recently Tamarid came out and said that they wanted an investigation of the violence, but also that seemed like they were also siding with the military, that this was an act of terror and self-defense of the state. And so the rhetoric sort of on both sides is rather troubling, because what we're getting are two extreme stories, that this was either some kind of massacre or it was defense against terrorists. And I personally am just always wary when I start to hear us versus them reactionary rhetoric. So as both Wael and Adel have said, the story about what happened this morning is yet to really unfold clearly, because all we have are these accounts of either side. But one of the things I did hope would come out was that the opposition would clearly take a position against the use of state violence against individuals, in addition to the use of violence by the part of the Muslim Brotherhood or whomever is on the streets with weapons. So the accusations, you know, the call for against violence needs to be both on the part of the civilians and on the part of the state.
And Wael, can you tell us more about the Egyptian military and just the amount of power that it has?
Well, the Egyptian military has everything that any entity would want, really. They have all the powers you can imagine. They have their own parallel economics. They have, estimates of 25 to 40% of Egypt's economy is in a separate economy related to the army. They act with impunity from civil law. They don't come under, their budget does not come under scrutiny. Their military law is not very effective in bringing about any kind of, and recently it's been constitutionalized, ironically, by the Muslim Brotherhood to give them even more powers in the constitution, where they're under no review, and they have the power to try civilians in a military court. And what this means effectively is that if an army officer is angry at someone, they can take them to military court, which is not very well known for its justice, and lock them up. So they have a lot of power at the moment, more power than there should be. And they are effectively the problem with the entire Egypt's regime. They have been in control since the 50s, and their powers have been growing and growing. And due to the mishandling of the Muslim Brotherhood of their rule, they've given the military even more appeal. And the military right now are restoring their reputation, which was greatly tarnished during the transitional period after 2011, when they took power.
And Adel, what would you add to this? Because there's been mass support for the military's decision to get involved here and remove Morsi. And in a recent piece in The Nation, Democracy Now!'s Sharif Abdel Qaddous wrote, quote, that a popular revolt facilitated Morsi's ouster is undeniable, but it has also solidified the military's role as the final arbiter of power in Egypt. So how do people view the military at this point?
Well, I mean, I think what we started this perfectly by saying that the military is now restoring its reputation after having been tarnished during the transition. I would probably add to that by saying that the military, in addition to getting the necessary sort of judicial and constitutional protection by the Muslim Brotherhood during this past period, what they've done is they've really capitalized on what exists. The Muslim Brotherhood's rise to power, which is essentially sort of a carte blanche that the Egyptians typically give to the military. Keep in mind that in addition to its enormous economic and political clout and reach and resources, the military has also been actively in the process of indoctrinating Egyptians to complete compliance for much of the past 6 years. The last 30 years, Egypt has not been engaged in any conflict whatsoever, but retains the right to mandatory draft conscription for most male citizens in the country. So everybody, has been through, or most men have been through the military service in one shape or another and have been subjected to this propaganda. I've also tried as best I can in articles I've written previously to document, and I've done a really remarkable job with it, to really document the incredible sort of immunity that the military has had.
And hold that thought, Adele. We've got to take a quick break. On today's Your Call, we are talking about the latest situation, the violence, the bloodshed, and the future of Egypt. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. We invite you to join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can post a comment or question at yourcallradio.org. You can also find links related to today's show and where you can sign up for the show's weekly email newsletter. That's all at yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we continue our Agenda for a New Economy series by talking about banking reform. Whatever happened to banking reform? What, if anything, has changed since the economic crisis in 2008? That's tomorrow. Wednesday, we will talk about the Supreme Court decisions. What is the legacy of John Roberts on the Supreme Court? And what do the decisions we got over the last few weeks tell us about the future of the court? Thursday, we'll talk about strikes this year so far in Northern California. We've got BART, Oakland workers, nurses, concession workers, so many people going on strike. We'll talk about the state of unionized workers in Northern California. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about the current situation in Egypt. On June 30th, over 20 million people poured into Cairo's iconic Tahrir Square and other cities across Egypt, demanding President Mohamed Morsi step down. On July 30th, with the direct intervention of the country's very powerful military, Morsi's one-year term came to an end. Over the weekend, clashes left at least 35 people dead. This morning, at least 51 people were killed during prayers outside of the barracks in Cairo, where President Morsi is reportedly being held. More than 430 people have been wounded, and there are just horrific scenes being described about the bloodshed this morning. So today, we're talking about the latest. We're also adding some context, which is also missing. So if you have any questions about what is happening on the ground, who are the major players? Do you want to know something about the Muslim Brotherhood? We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. If you're from Egypt, do you have any ties there? What are you hearing from friends and family? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website. We're joined today by Wael Eskandar, blogger and writer for Egypt's Aram Online. He's been writing about the protests. He joins us from Cairo. Adele Eskandar is a scholar of Arab studies. He's a lecturer at Georgetown. His most recent book is Egypt in Flux, Essays on an Unfinished Revolution. And Mona Atai is assistant professor of geography and international affairs at George Washington University. And she just came back from Egypt. And let's hear from our listeners. Let's go to Max in Berkeley. Hi, Max. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call, and thank you for a good program. You're doing a good job as usual.
Thank you.
I have a quick comment. First of all, this thing must be put in a much larger context. In the First World War, we had the Kemal Atatürk revolution in Turkey, which was anti-clerical. Ironically, 80 years later, political Islam has reemerged there with a vengeance. In Iran, we had the Shah, who, in the name of a certain modernity, suppressed the clerics. That led to Khomeini. In Algeria, in the 90s, you had a civil war following the blockage of the election there, the electoral process, and at a cost of 200,000 people plus. In Egypt, for the last 60 years, the army ruled the show, pretty much, and it was very much anti-clerical, by and large, very repressively so. So we are seeing the reemergence there of political Islam. It's clearly a broader problem in the Middle East. And there is a real difficulty of political Islam with the separation of religion and the state. There is a huge problem. It's a much broader problem. And I'll stop here and I'll take your comment up here.
Okay, thank you, Max. Mona, would you like to take that one first?
I mean, of course, yeah, it's relevant to put it in the context of both the rise of Islamist politics and popular mobilization across the globe. And I guess my response is that what's extremely troubling about the current moment is the sentiment that the Muslim Brotherhood should be marginalized, that they no longer are a welcome part of the political process, that they're being demonized, which goes against, again, consensus building and consensus politics, which really needs to be a part of the political context moving forward. So on the other hand, you know, this was a popular mobilization and removal of faith in Morsi as the president. And so, you know, there needs to be an effort moving forward then to sort of bring those groups together. And what we're seeing is actually the opposite, which is the creation of extreme divides amongst the population, even amounting into a media warfare.
Adele, what would you add to that? Max's question about just the rise of political Islam in the Middle East.
Well, I mean, I think one has to be cautioned by the fact that the protests that came out against the Muslim Brotherhood cannot be described as secular, liberal, or oppositional to political Islam in the grander scheme of things. I mean, there were. There were a lot of pious, religious, observant communities. It was very cross-cutting. So the protest movement, the protest movement itself, speaks to perhaps a different vision of the relationship between Islam and the state, rather than sort of a natural animosity towards political Islam as an ideological sort of hotbed for mobilization. So this is, you know, a very interesting dimension. I think it creates sort of a breakthrough between those natural sort of binaries that we've come to accept, that it's either the military or political Islam, that there's a third space. But unfortunately, you know, in the last maybe week or so, we're seeing that those two polarities are once again trying to assert themselves. It's either the military or political Islam. And there's a real need for there to be a third space, that asserts itself. But, you know, it's not marginalization of political Islam is not going to succeed in the grand scheme of things. And really, to kind of revisit and rehistoricize the past 60 years, I mean, keep in mind, it was under Hosni Mubarak that actually political Islam flourished underground, you know, both through, you know, the actions of his police state, but also because he creates the platform for the Muslim Brotherhood to run in parliamentary elections and to secure seats and to come into the political arena, which was very different from Nasser's position, which was much more aggressive and much more confrontational. So I think, you know, once you look at the nuances, it's a little bit more complicated than, you know, the military subduing the Muslim Brotherhood consistently, especially over the last 2 years, where the military has really created a platform for the rise of the Muslim Brotherhood because of assurances that they gave the military, that they were going to give them necessary protections constitutionally that we've described thus far. So it's a little bit more complicated than what the caller is alluded.
Wael, do you agree with that it's a little more complicated than that? I mean,
I do agree with Adel about that. It's as simple as the rise of political Islam. This has been nurtured by the military throughout these past years as in search of a political ally. But I also think that political Islam has been in a very, very long underground, and this is the only way it knew how to thrive. And one of the things, one of the biggest challenges was coming out actually dealing publicly. Islamists have been, in Egypt at least, they've been used to dealing with the security forces and having underhanded deals or something of that sort. So when they came out publicly and when transparency was needed, it did not fit the times, because the people really wanted a real change. They were not seeking some kind of rule from a past era. So I feel that that part as well is important to put into account.
Well, are people seeing changes on the ground because of this?
There are a lot of changes in the fabric of society itself, and their idea of political Islam has been, it's been given a blow, because there was this idea that these Islamists had this kind of grand scheme of things, but they were hindered by Mubarak's regime and the oppression. And when they finally came to light, they understood that they just wanted to reach power rather than have a specific project in which they could help the country forward. And these kind of realizations have changed society and their perception of political Islam, or even those Islamists as kinds of preachers as well. They've it's been found out that they're not exactly who they say they are.
What will happen with the Muslim Brotherhood if the military continues arresting their members and shutting down their papers? Wael?
Well, this will probably be the worst scenario, which reinforces the police state. The Brotherhood already have taken a huge blow, where they can they do not really believe in the ballot box anymore to bring about change, because when they came to power, they weren't able to affect the change they wanted. The trick is to tell them that democracy, where you can thrive and be represented, rather than change the Egyptian identity. So if there is on the Muslim Brotherhood, they will remain a threat, and the culture of fear from Islamists and the Muslim Brotherhood will thrive, instead of the idea that it diminishes now that they've come to power. It will introduce fear again into society, I think, and I think that's why they should not be ostracized completely, and they should be incorporated in whatever new political framework that they come up with.
All right, well, thank you for the question, Max. Let's go next to Mustafa in San Francisco. Hi, Mustafa, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me again. I talked to you on January 25th, 2011, when we started the revolution, the same times. And I thought at that time we will change the regime, because I'm sure we will at that time. Mm-hmm. But what's happening is when we remove Mubarak regime, actually with the Egyptian people, I guess he removed Mubarak only, but not his regime. Imagine everywhere in Egyptian society, thousands of corruption people. That's what's happening now. I talked with my family yesterday or the day before. They said most of the Mubarak regime coming back. You know, so it's not against the Muslim Brotherhood. It's against the democracy.
All right. Thank you, Mustafa. Yep. We'll get a comment after we take a few more calls. Let's hear from Karen in Berkeley. Hi, Karen.
Rose, yes. I'd like to put this out for you and the listening audience. What are the similarities between what's happening in Egypt and what has been happening in the United States? We have actually a democratically elected president who is continuing all of the right-wing extreme fundamental rules, like the Patriot Act and the NDAA Act and indefinite detention. We had militarized police forces all across this country beating in the heads of protesters at the Occupy movement. We're going to be spending another $64 billion to militarize our border. We've got drones. We've got tanks in cities. We've got people beating everybody's heads in that are protesting all over the country. We've got basically a Congress that's frozen, not being able to move, which is how they're describing the Egyptian Congress. We've got right-wing fundamentalist extremists running the Congress. We've got corporations controlling the Congress. So we really haven't got a big democracy going on in this country. And now with the revelation that our government is listening to everything we say or do or buy or go or eat or books from the library, we've basically got something like Behind the Iron Curtain in Berlin in 1956.
Well, Karen, thank you for calling. We're actually going to do a show about all of this in the near future. So thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Let's go next to Eid in Berkeley. Hi, Eid.
Good morning. Yeah, well, I think the nightmare of the Brotherhood is over. I think that the
They exactly did what I expect them to do. They are hated and despised by Egyptian community for the last 80 years. And all what Morsi wanted was what is good for the Brotherhood, which he has to Islamize Egypt. You can never Islamize Egypt. Egypt is not Iran, it's not Turkey, as the first caller said. Egypt always has been a secular country, the birthplace of Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. And the last thing I'd like to say, we all have to work with the Egyptian military and government and have everybody inclusive and included in the, so that we have peace very soon. They're not going to be bloodshed. Egypt's not going to be Algeria, neither would it be Syria or anything like that. We are going to be Egypt the Great, which is what Egypt is. That's why Morsi failed in just a year, in 1 year, and he was hated by everybody. My family hated him. Everybody in Cairo hated him. Mostly, he just totally damaged Egypt beyond repair in the year that he was in. Well, hopefully it will be repaired. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. While you're in Cairo, what are you hearing on the streets from people about the Muslim Brotherhood? What's in store for them for the future?
I think the caller has just echoed the exact sentiments in Egypt for those who don't support the Muslim Brotherhood. The Muslim Brotherhood identity is now despised, and there's a huge danger in that, because let's take, for example, what happened today. You will find a lot of people justifying the military's actions against the Muslim Brotherhood, which is a grave danger. But the Muslim Brotherhood, over the past few days as well, some of their supporters have opened fire on neighborhoods in Cairo, and a lot of the people have been killed in these neighborhoods, which is largely unreported. But also, if you go to different governorates, the sentiment against the Muslim Brotherhood as an identity of people who see themselves they're mostly supremacist. There is this kind of rejection of the Muslim Brotherhood identity, and I feel that Egyptians, it will be very difficult for them to accept integrating again with the Muslim Brotherhood after their rule, how much they've messed up.
And Mona, what would you add to that?
I agree that there's sort of an hatred and anger towards the Muslim Brotherhood at the moment. I think the pendulum swings both ways in terms of popular sentiment towards the Muslim Brotherhood. Right now we're witnessing a sort of an extreme against. But I would also add that there's an ongoing struggle that will continue over the role of religion in society and in the public sphere. And as Adil said, that it's not such a clear cut of, secularists versus Islamists, that in fact what we're seeing are divides across completely different lines. And so I also think it's very premature to sort of discount the role of Islamist politics in Egypt moving forward, as demonstrated even recently by the ability of the Noor party to block the appointment of Baradei as prime minister, of the ongoing negotiations between other Islamist parties who are at the table right now, most notably the Noor party. So thinking about that there are many other actors other than just the Muslim Brotherhood, but continuing to sort of marginalize the Brotherhood is extremely dangerous, and I think that would backfire.
And do you agree with that, Adel?
I completely agree with it. I think marginalizing the Muslim Brotherhood would have a very, very hefty cost for the political future of Egypt, if not the fabric of society. But nevertheless, the Muslim Brotherhood should take lessons from their past year of rule and their period of extensive victimization over the last 60 years under various sort of levels of military rule, and really sort of rescind their natural sort of groupthink, if you will. The fact that what is best for this view that what is best for the Brotherhood must be best for Egypt. The inconsistency and the sort of incongruity between the Muslim Brotherhood's vision for Egypt in the future and the expectations of Egyptians at mass is really one of the biggest sort of lessons learned from the past couple of years. And any sort of step forward from here on will have to kind of reconcile with this issue.
I want to, if you don't mind, I want to speak to the first caller.
Yes.
Mustafa, who said something about how the Mubarakites and the former NDP and are kind of reemerging now and becoming a substantial force. I would argue against that. I would say that even though they have become political players within the opposition today, or they're at least looking for an opportunity to take advantage of this rise against the Muslim Brotherhood and the political status quo, to a large extent, they're being marginalized by both Tamarrud as a movement and every other oppositional figure. So it's going to be extremely difficult for the old regime to resuscitate itself. I think the revolution has a logic of its own. It dismisses it dismisses the Mubarak regime, it dismisses the Muslim Brotherhood, and it also dismisses the military as well. Within this whole discussion, there's still very, very strong vocal voices out there that are criticizing the actions of the military against the Brotherhood, while at the same time holding the Muslim Brotherhood to account. So there are sort of complications here. It's not easy to dismiss the opposition on the grounds of being sort of the former regime rearing its ugly head again.
Mm. There was an op-ed in the New York Times recently by Khaled Abdul El-Fadi. He's a professor at UCLA, and he writes, now after the coup and keeping with the long-honored tradition of double standards, the military council has announced that it respects the right of freedom of expression, association, and demonstration as long as it does not endanger public security. The army continues to cheer for the demonstrators in Tahrir, even as it is arresting and repressing those demonstrating elsewhere in favor of Morsi. Sadly, he writes, democracy will not take hold in Egypt unless Egyptians learn that the only way to challenge the ballot box is by the ballot box, and that the sanctity of the process must always trump the desirability of the results. What are your thoughts on that, Wael?
This is, I think, is the biggest problem that we're facing, this sort of rhetoric of the ballot box. I think that a lot of analysts and a lot of people mistake democracy for the ballot box. Mubarak was never removed through a ballot box. Sure, you can say that Morsi was elected democratically, even if you accept that. But that accepts as well that the military is the one who held these democratic elections. Of course, I reject that as well. But the problem is not whether someone comes through a ballot box. The problem is if someone upholds the values of democracy. And Morsi clearly hasn't done that, and that's why he's being removed. When it comes to questions of how to remove someone who is not acting democratically, I don't think the ballot box is an answer. And I think that's a huge flaw in that argument altogether.
What about the other argument, Mona, that the military can go after the same activists who have been opposing Morsi if they disagree with their actions?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's absolutely necessary that the Egyptian people put the military in check in terms of their power, and sort of having this sense that the military is the savior and that they're a benign actor and that they can do no wrong. The military has its interests. It will continue to secure its interests. And depending on, you know, who's on the other side of opposing those interests, you know, people will be subject to the wrath of the military. So in terms of, you know, of what Wes said, I completely agree that democracy is not about the ballot box. That's just one element of a democracy. Democracy is about everyday practice. The goals of the revolution and the goals of democracy have not been attained. And so, you know, there continues to be a struggle on the ground to assert those. And the military, you know, may have temporarily articulated that it's trying to protect those interests. But I think that, you know, the indiscriminate violence that we witness today really should be a wake-up call to Egypt that, you know, there are many factors at play in that, you know, there should be some concern that Egypt is still in the midst of a military police state. So, you know, there really needs to be some organizing amongst the opposition, and for that there is, it exists, but what's being articulated right now is it seems to be a sort of weak stance. So hopefully in the coming days we'll start to see a real strong stance against the military police state.
And Wael, we have a question about violence against women. Ted writes, we've been so in awe of these brave protesters who want a better life, then we're shocked about the rape and beating of women, as well as the men who tried to rescue them. We don't understand how this could happen. These women were also participating in the protests, but women protesting against repression are not supposed to be there. Why? Because they're women, he writes. Human Rights Watch reports that at least 91 attacks against women happened in just 4 days, and the government isn't doing anything about it. They're saying that it's rampant sexual attacks during the June 30th protests. Can you talk a little bit about this?
Yes, this has been happening for quite a while, particularly in huge gatherings in Tahrir, like when there's a big day of protests. We have to understand that sexual violence is a weapon to the regime, for the regime, and they've been using it ever since the Mubarak era, and that's there are very famous cases where they have. And this extension of the regime, the people did not really bring down this police state completely, and it's, the networks are still intact. And sexual violence was used against these against women in protests. Now, these kind of attacks are generally, a lot of them are organized. Of course, there's the problem of sexual harassment that's there. But what we're talking about these attacks, they're usually organized attacks inside the square that target women. And it's a group of maybe 10 to 50 people who start these attacks, and then it picks off from there. Mm. And, you know, there's been groups that have been fighting this for intervention to try and intervene and help save some women when such an attack starts. There has been a BBC show that interviewed actually two people who were partaking in the attacks, and they claimed they were paid. Now, this cannot be substantiated, but it's not very unlikely that this kind of stuff is actually orchestrated by some elements within government or the police or so on to undermine protests. This is, you know, I don't. A lot of people are in disbelief that such a thing can happen in pro-democracy rallies and so on, but it has been happening and has been quite an issue. But the government, as a stance, they have never taken action against sexual violence, so it persists.
And Mona, we have just about 20 seconds left. Final thoughts from you. What are you hearing from female friends and family in Egypt about this?
Well, there's been an ongoing campaign by Operation Anti-Sexual Harassment and Tahrir Bodyguards against the violence against women that's been happening, that's been rampant, that was extremely disturbing over the 4 days of the most recent popular mobilization. So I think that the violence against women is, in fact, you know, partially orchestrated by, you know, groups.
And we're going to have to leave it there. Sorry to cut you off there. There's just so much to talk about, and we'll definitely continue this discussion. Mona Atai, Adel Iskandar, and Wael Eskandar, thank you so much for joining us. Thanks for listening. It's Your Call. How should the U.S. banking system be reformed? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about what, if anything, has changed since the 2008 financial crisis. In 2010, President Obama signed the Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act into law. But since then, the financial industry has spent more than $1 billion to water it down. So what should be done to make sure the crisis doesn't happen again? And why do banks have so much power? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.